Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
And, you know, she had came into my life during a real dark moment. And I had asked her, is it selfish of me to want my life back knowing that I took a life? And she said, no.
And, I mean, we all make mistakes.
And you served your time.
And you served your time, but it's just, it's so much. It's so much that goes on with that process, and it's so much growth, it's so much development, it's so much. Man, I can't explain it.
The board and parole staff have received training on adolescent development that we helped helped formulate, and the hearings themselves focus much more on rehabilitation, on maturity, and how youth is more than just a chronological fact.
I'm Sarah Fenske. This is St. Louis on the Air. In June of 1986, Kevin Bradshaw did something unthinkable. He killed a 73-year-old woman. She was home alone when Kevin broke into her house, drunk and high and planning to burglarize the place. When she came out of a dark bedroom and surprised him, he attacked her. And when she fought back, he strangled her. Kevin Bradshaw was convicted of second-degree murder, robbery, and burglary. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. And that's even though he was just a kid, really. Kevin Bradshaw turned 17 one month before the murder. He was 18 when he was sent to prison. And he was never supposed to get out. In the 1980s and 90s, teenagers who committed heinous crimes were thought to be incorrigible. But many things have changed about the way Americans think about juvenile offenders. And this fall, Kevin Bradshaw was released from prison 34 years after being sentenced to life without parole. He's not alone. Eight men sentenced to life for crimes committed as juveniles have now been released from Missouri's prison system. Each served more than 25 years, and each believed they'd never see freedom again. On today's show, we'll meet Kevin Bradshaw. We'll also meet others like him, and we'll hear from one of their victims. But first, we'll hear from Amy Bryan. Amy was a young lawyer at one of the city's top law firms, now Brian Cave Leighton Paisner, when she was first assigned Kevin Bradshaw's case. But Kevin's case would change her life, and Amy Bryan joins us to take it from here. Amy, welcome.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me.
So how did you end up getting assigned to represent Kevin in 2012?
Yeah, in 2012, there was a watershed case that came out from the U.S. Supreme Court that invalidated mandatory life without parole sentences for kids. And then WashU law professor Mae Quinn organized a consortium of attorneys to help represent those folks impacted by that decision to seek remedy in the court. And I was one of the attorneys who signed on to help with that effort. Got to know Mae Quinn through that and got to know Kevin through that work.
So when you were assigned to this case, did you initially think he strangled an elderly woman? He must be a monster.
No, I didn't. Because I met Kevin shortly after taking the case on, and it was clear from that very first meeting that he was not the same person as that young 17-year-old was back in 1986. That thought honestly never crossed my mind. I know that's a very serious crime, and I never took that lightly, but it was clear from the go that he was more than that one act.
And I'd like you to give us a little bit of context here. Kevin is not alone in this situation of having been very young when he did something that was very terrible, but what did the Supreme Court find in this Miller case when it came to juveniles who commit these kind of crimes?
So the Miller decision that was released in 2012 is one in a line of cases from the United States Supreme Court related to the extreme sentencing of kids. And very simply put, that decision said that mandatory imposition of a life without parole sentence on kids is cruel and unusual, even where they commit very serious crimes like first-degree murder. And why is that? Well, very simply put, because children are different. And the reasons that a court might sentence an adult to life without parole, they're diminished when you're talking about a kid who is more impulsive and impetuous, more susceptible to peer pressure, more driven by reward than punishment, doesn't appreciate consequences, and is less able to extricate themselves or move themselves from negative situations and community pressures, and whose character is less formed than a 46-year-old. I mean, that's an intuitive proposition, but also a very profound one that counsels against locking kids up for life.
In this decision, did the court address the risk that if they were let out, these guys could commit crimes again?
The court discussed what are referred to as the penological justifications for a sentence like life without parole. In other words, why do we send people to prison? To punish them, to deter bad behavior, to remove a risk from society, that's certainly a part of that. And all of those justifications are weakened when you're talking about a kid, because the acts that folks commit when they are children, even very serious crimes, are not necessarily reflective of who they will be forever. I mean, I think that's something, again, that's intuitive that we all know because we were teenagers. Some of us have children. We've seen that play out. But it's also based in science, brain development, adolescent development.
So this Supreme Court ruling, this came out in 2012, and it said you can't give these kind of sentences to juveniles within the system anymore. When did that become retroactive? And so it would affect people like Kevin, who had been sentenced decades before.
Well, arguably, the Miller decision in and of itself was retroactive to folks who had already been sentenced. But it wasn't until 4 years later in 2016 when the court issued another decision, Montgomery decision, which said clearly and unequivocally that Miller does apply retroactively to individuals who, like Kevin and other folks we'll hear from today, have already been sentenced to these unconstitutional mandatory life without parole sentences. So it was really that 2016 decision that made it clear cut. By then, of course, litigation across the country and here in Missouri had already been ongoing for several years, trying to seek remedy and redress for people like Kevin who've been serving unconstitutional sentences.
So in addition to Amy Bryan, who's the attorney who has handled his case, we're also joined today by Kevin Bradshaw, whose case I was discussing earlier there and who Amy continues to represent. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay.
Kevin, when you first met Amy, did you have any hope at that point of getting out of prison?
No, I didn't think I did.
And Kevin, I'm having a hard time hearing you. I don't know if you can kind of adjust the way you're holding your phone. You had been in prison almost 3 decades at that point. How had prison changed you?
It made me smarter, made me more considerate of other people.
And so those years that you were in there, was this a time that you thought a lot about what you had done?
Yeah, you think about that every day.
And what did you think as you thought about it?
Mainly of the victim, not so much as myself, but of my victim. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a grandmother. I had grandmothers, and it seemed I could have been trying to learn more from the older people in the community instead of being a problem for the community.
Mm-hmm. And so you realized that this was a very serious thing that you'd done. What did you do in prison to try to make remedy for the actions that you took?
I took classes, stuff that was available, anger management, anything that was available to give me a little bit more insight into myself.
Mm-hmm. And what did you learn as you took those classes to try to gain that insight into yourself?
Basically, there was more to me than the behavior that I had exhibited to get in prison.
Mm-hmm. Amy, as you got to know Kevin, did you guys talk a lot about, how he had changed since that date?
Yeah, that was always part of the conversation, especially as we looked toward the possibility of parole review, which really only became a reality in the last several years. There were many years where Kevin's case was working its way through the court system, and the focus has always been on his rehabilitation, his maturity, his change over time, because that's really what the Supreme Court has said, which is that for those juveniles who committed serious crimes but demonstrate maturity and rehabilitation over time, their hope for life outside of prison must be restored.
Mm-hmm. So after, we know now there's a very firm ruling saying that this is retroactive, that the Missouri prison system can't wiggle away from that. Did you get a chance to present signs of Kevin's growth and talk about what he had done in prison to try to change the road he was on? Were you given a chance to do that before the Missouri Parole Board?
No, and then yes. So, Kevin had two different hearings in front of the parole board, or a hearing panel, which is a small portion of the parole board. And the first hearing, I think he was denied that opportunity, like so many other individuals, which is what prompted the MacArthur Justice Center and Hush Blackwell to file a class action lawsuit against the parole board, which we won, and which led to a number of reforms in the system. And then Kevin had a second hearing, and I would say, yes, he had an opportunity. I got to be there along with his family, and he can speak more to that if he'd like, but he definitely got an opportunity to discuss his change over time.
And I would love to have Kevin speak to that, but you also mentioned the MacArthur Justice Center. I know you're now the co-director of that here in St. Louis, but when we had last mentioned your work as a lawyer, you were still at a white-collar type firm. At what point did you switch over to working for this firm, and was that related to your passion for helping people like Kevin?
Yeah, in 2016, the MacArthur Justice Center opened its Missouri office here in St. Louis, and I left Brian Cave to join the office then as a staff attorney, along with our then director, May Quinn, and it was very much related to this work. I had always wanted to do public interest work, and this was a fantastic opportunity to do that, and my connection with May through this Miller work facilitated that. So really, really feel very grateful and fortunate for the opportunity.
And so the MacArthur Justice Center ended up filing this class action lawsuit. It changes the way parole is handled in Missouri, and that's because you won that lawsuit. You were able to win on summary judgment. Kevin, I'd love to hear about how that then affected your chances. You had been before the parole board. They turned you down. How did things go that second time?
The second time, it gave me the opportunity to really speak to take them back and let them know the environment I grew up in prison, and how hard it was to free myself from a certain mentality. And the fact that I had did it, that I had done that, I just simply asked them to consider all that, to consider that and give me the opportunity to show them what I was capable of as a human being and not just another criminal incarcerated.
And Amy, it wasn't just Kevin's words. There were just sort of some fundamental changes made to this parole process because of this class action lawsuit. Can you give us a couple examples of some of the other things that changed?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So under the old process, someone like in Kevin's position would go before a hearing panel that just had one board member on it. It was a very short hearing. It focused on the facts of the crime. There was inadequate consideration of youth. It was secretive. Kevin didn't have access to any of the information that was used against him, and he was only allowed to have one support person there who couldn't speak to anything other than support upon release. That has all changed. Now hearings are in front of a two-board panel, which will increase to three if the two vacant seats on the parole board are filled. They're lengthier hearings. The board and parole staff have received training on adolescent development that we helped formulate. And the hearings themselves focus much more on rehabilitation, on maturity, and how youth is more than just a chronological fact. There's greater transparency and access to information. And an inmate can now have four delegates present, and one of those can be an attorney who can actually advocate, whereas before we were told very clearly that it was not a lawyering moment, and we're in fact told at one point by DOC Director Preseith that we couldn't even take notes. So that has all all changed for the better.
So those are some big changes, and it ended up leading to a huge change for Kevin's case. Kevin, you were granted parole. Do you remember where you were when you found out that you got this release date?
In the housing unit.
And what was your reaction when you were told this?
I don't know. I didn't think it hit until I walked in. When I went back to my room to get the information for what I'm going to be released to, that's when it kind of hit me.
And when it hit you, I mean, did you have a sense of, hey, here's what I'm going to do on the outside? Or were you not even able to get your head around that?
No, my roommate was there, and we were close. And he asked me what was wrong. I couldn't get it out. I told him I'm going home, and I started crying. He grabbed me.
That's
kind of how it went.
That's quite a moment. And then after 34 years, Kevin did get out. We're talking today to Kevin Bradshaw. He was doing time for a murder he committed when he was 17. He was released this fall. We're also talking to Amy Bryan. She's the co-director of the Roderick and Solange MacArthur Justice Center here in St. Louis. And both Kevin and Amy will join us again later this hour. But first, after we take a quick break, we'll meet another lawyer working on these cases and another young man who is just tasting freedom. We'll be back shortly. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. Before the break, we talked to Amy Bryan, co-director of the MacArthur Justice Center in St. Louis. We also talked to her client, Kevin Bradshaw. He was released from prison this fall after 34 years. And we'll get back to Amy and Kevin in a bit. But first, let's meet another man who also served a long time in prison. Kevin was Amy's first client in the class of former juvenile offenders sentenced to life without parole in Missouri. But he was not the first Missouri man to be released from prison after Amy and her colleagues won a lawsuit aimed at giving these men fair parole hearings. 98 men were represented in that class action lawsuit, and the first one to be released under the new protocols established in that lawsuit is Christopher Polk. He was released in September after 24 years in prison. And Christopher's attorney is Megan Crane. Like Amy, she's a co-director at the MacArthur Justice Center, and she joins us today. Megan, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Sarah.
So, Megan, we heard a little bit about Amy's story. What brought you into this case?
Well, thank you. I grew up in St. Louis, first of all. I had been working away as an attorney for the past decade and been away from St. Louis for about 20 years. But I had long watched and admired MacArthur's work from afar. They were doing creative and groundbreaking systemic litigation to attack injustice across the country, including here in my home state of Missouri. So when a position opened up in this office, it was simply an opportunity I couldn't pass up to come home to St. Louis, but also to join Amy and Mae Quinn and MacArthur's fight against the juvenile lifer problem here in Missouri. I was just gonna say, I had previously worked as a death penalty attorney and then a juvenile justice attorney. And this work really is an intersection of those two fields. And I loved what was happening here in Missouri, where we were attacking the problem on a large systemic scale, in addition to representing these clients in an individual level. So I jumped at the chance to join MacArthur and to join this case.
So we're going to meet one of your individual clients here in just a minute. But first, when you took on Christopher Polk's case, what did you learn about what Christopher had been convicted of?
Yeah, similar to Kevin, Chris grew up in St. Louis in an urban neighborhood. And at 17 years old, he was arrested and eventually charged with first-degree murder for a middle-of-the-night shooting during a botched robbery on a city sidewalk that tragically left one young man dead and another seriously wounded. But no one was arrested or charged for that crime for over 6 months. And by all accounts, there were three perpetrators, but only two were ever arrested. And Chris's co-defendant, an adult man, he flipped when the state offered him a deal of a couple years in exchange for testifying against Chris. So he's been a free man for years, while Chris was sentenced to die in prison as a 17-year-old kid.
Wow. Well, we're also joined today here by that former 17-year-old kid, and that is Christopher Polk. Christopher, welcome.
Thank you. How you doing?
So, Christopher, before you were sent away to prison, I know you lived in the Hamilton Heights neighborhood of St. Louis. Your father was a crack addict. Your mother was overwhelmed by health problems. What was your childhood like?
I said my childhood was, me being a child, I viewed it as normal. Mm-hmm. But reflecting as an adult, there wasn't anything normal about it. Mm-hmm. I say it was rough.
Were you able to get much of an education there in North St. Louis?
Well, not really. The environment was pretty toxic.
Mm-hmm. And I understand your mother's health problems. That meant you ended up going to live with your grandmother. Was that tough?
Yeah, that's when it got tough. When I went to live with my grandmother.
So, Megan, in the bigger picture, what do we know about this group of young men who was sentenced to life without parole in Missouri? Do they largely have backgrounds like Christopher's?
Exactly. We have 98 men, including a couple women, serving juvenile life without parole here in Missouri. A shocking 40 of those 98 cases came out of St. Louis City. And like both Kevin and Chris, 39 of those 40 are Black men. Mm-hmm. So they were Black teenagers living in the urban neighborhoods of St. Louis City, growing up in the 80s and 90s during the height of the crack epidemic here. And it's really sad to say their stories are remarkably similar. They grew up in neighborhoods that were dominated by violence, guns, gangs, and crimes. And it's important to note that in the 80s and early 90s, across the country, this era was known as the super predator era, when it was a popular talking point for politicians to label teens of color, particularly Black boys, as super predators who were just out there wilding in the streets. And I think Kevin and Chris are certainly a product of that toxic myth that dominated our criminal justice system.
So, Chris, when you were sent away to prison, you were still very young. You were in there for a long time before there began to be that glimmer of hope, thanks to attorneys like Megan. Did you ever give up during those long years of thinking this was going to go on for the rest of your life?
To be honest with you, I couldn't really say I gave up. Mm-hmm. I can say I was frustrated, but I always had some type of hope. That's how I would describe my situation.
And what gave you that hope? Did you think maybe at some point the circumstance could change and you'd get a chance at parole?
I just believed that one day I would be liberated. I believed one day that I would be free. I believed that.
And you continued to go to church and you took classes. Were you doing those things because you were hoping it would look good in front of a parole board if you ever got that chance?
Well, I was doing those things long before the parole board ever came into play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So who were you doing that for? Were you doing that just for yourself?
I was doing that to nurture my spirit. I was doing that to keep myself strong. I was doing it because I thought it was the right thing to do.
Well, Christopher, you had a really surprising person supporting your release. Robert Kramer is the brother of the man that Christopher was convicted of killing, and he now lives in West Des Moines, Iowa. He said he reached out to Christopher while Christopher was in prison. This is after hearing from a cousin who was incarcerated with him. And Robert Kramer spoke to me about this. He told me he had a good conversation with Chris. They continued to talk by phone. And ultimately, Robert Kramer decided to support Christopher's request for parole. He even drove down from Iowa to speak at this parole hearing. And he told me what led him to do that.
The whole process of going down there and supporting him and going before the board, the parole board, and all that—it was actually pretty easy. That process of getting it. And as I got inside of the parole board, it got a little harder because I started telling my story. Mm-hmm. And when I told my story, I told it from me and my brother as growing up together and how close we were and how I felt over the years about Christopher Pope until the transformation of how me and him developed a relationship and how forgiveness and how I understood that, you know, I grew up in the same environment Christopher Pope grew up in, Like I told the parole board, I was probably three decisions away from probably being where he is now, where he was at the time, you know? So I had, you know, I said I didn't condone what he did. I never do that. I never condone what he did. I just told him, you know, I understand at the time he was a juvenile, the environment, everything around him. I understood because I grew up in that. And the person that I know now is Christopher Pope. That's not him.
That's Robert Kramer. His brother, Dante Kramer, was murdered in 1994. Chris, when you heard from Robert Kramer and you developed this friendship, were you surprised that he began to say he thought of you like a brother?
Around the time I talked to Robert, well, how I would describe that is divine intervention.
Mm-hmm.
I always had a lot of faith. I always prayed to God. And it's amazing, and I call him my brother in Christ, and it's divine intervention. It's all God.
Well, I asked Robert Kramer what he hopes people take from his testimony before the parole board, and here's what he told me.
I would say that to people that I hope that I'm an example that God is real, forgiveness is real, and that condemnation is not ours to give, especially when it comes to the youth and people who make bad youthful decisions. And condemnation is not ours to give, and I believe forgiveness and humility is one of God's greatest gifts. If I can forgive a person who killed my brother and and build a relationship and treat him as he is my younger brother, man, the little petty stuff is neither here nor there. It becomes really insignificant. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would say to folks out there.
And that is Robert Kramer. Megan, what went through your mind as you heard him testify in front of the parole board?
Wow. That was one of the most profound and emotional moments of my life. It just was a true moment of restorative justice and felt like grace, you know, witnessing grace and humanity in the most tangible way sitting in that room that I've ever experienced.
Mm. And that testimony may well have made a big difference. Chris was granted parole. Chris, tell me about that day you got out of prison. What was that like?
Boy, it was the most beautiful day in the world that I can recall. Man, it was an out of body experience. Mm. It was something, to be honest with you, though. Although I anticipated it, I anticipated that moment all my life.
Yeah.
I'm at a loss for words. I'm kind of nervous.
And Chris, you're doing great here. I mean, just hearing you say that, I think we can all feel that emotion you were feeling. But that wonderful day, at the same time, I know your mother died in May and you were let out in September. Does it hurt knowing that she didn't live to see that day?
Yeah, I still think about that every day I get off work and come to the house. I still think about that every day.
We're talking today to Christopher Polk. He was released in September after 24 years in Missouri prison. And he'll stay with us after the break. We're also talking to Megan Crane. She's the co-director of the MacArthur Justice Center. And Megan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for telling these stories, Sarah.
We do need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll hear from a young man who's still doing time, waiting for his release date. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation. Earlier on today's show, we heard from both Kevin Bradshaw and Christopher Polk. They were both paroled in September after being sent to prison for crimes they committed as teenagers. Kevin did 34 years in Missouri's prison system. Chris did 27. Since the MacArthur Justice Center filed a class action lawsuit against the Missouri Parole Board, four other men sentenced as juveniles have been released on parole. Another 13 have been granted release dates, and now they're waiting for those days to come. One of those is Sidney Roberts. Sidney killed a man in a fist fight in St. Louis in 1988. He felt like he lost control in the fight. He was mortified when he learned the guy had died. He was 17 years old. Sidney was sentenced to life without parole and was sent to the Missouri State Penitentiary, also known as the Walls. It was a tough place, as he told me in a call from prison 2 weeks ago. He was just 5 feet, 2 inches tall, and he saw a lot of violence.
I seen stabbings. You know, I seen pipe whippings, beatings. I seen a person get stabbed to death in the gym. That really shook me there, because to see that happen, and it's like, it tells you, shows you that it can happen to anybody and won't nobody help you. You know, it was a humbling experience back there in the Walls.
And Sidney Roberts told me it was hard to keep from despair during his decades behind bars. But he kept working, and he volunteered for a prison program working with suicidal inmates. Doing time in isolation, he said, could be brutal. He understood how they felt and wanted to help. He even learned American Sign Language to better communicate with some deaf men in that program. And he told me the advice that he gave them.
Well, I just tell them, man, you know, just think about your loved ones, you know. Because you're not only going to hurt yourself, you'll hurt your loved ones, you know. And I told them, you know, it's okay to get tired, but don't give in to it. You know, and that was coming from my own experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, because having life with no parole and have to deal with so much madness, it will tap into your sanity. Mm-hmm. And if you're not mentally strong, you can be overcome by that.
Now, when Sidney Roberts was first sent away, he insisted another guy had been the killer. But he ended up admitting the truth within a few years. I asked him why.
It's like it was my conscience, you know, and I did a lot of self-reflecting, you know, and I knew I wanted my life back. So I have a pen pal. Her name is Lynn. And, you know, she had came into my life during a real dark moment. Mm-hmm. And I had asked her, is it selfish of me to want my life back, knowing that I took a life? And she said, no, just pray to God about it. Hmm. But it was a reflection. Then, you know, I watched First 48. And you ever seen the First 48?
I have seen that, yeah.
Okay. And when the officers, the detectives tell, especially mothers of murder victims, mm-hmm. that their family member was found dead, to hear them break down like that, that kind of moved me, you know, it moved me. Then I'm not no diabolical person, you know. I'm a man with a heart. Mm-hmm. You know, I care about people. And I think you have to be a detached person to not, you know, feel remorse for crimes that you commit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's just my views.
So when you decided to accept that responsibility and to come to terms and admit, yes, I took a life, and to know, you know, what you might have done to a family as you saw on the First 48, how did it change you on the inside to accept responsibility for what you'd done?
Well, I feel much better, man. I felt relieved, mm-hmm. to be able to own up to what I did.
Now, Sidney, at the same time, as much as you're owning up to what you did, you really had a really tough childhood. I know both of your parents used crack and your dad was abusive to your mom. Do you blame your upbringing?
Yes,
that if you'd grown up in a different way, you wouldn't have gotten in that situation in the first place?
Well, I don't, you know, one thing I learned about the situation of my parents, you know, Like I didn't know I loved my father until my father had passed, due to the abuse that I witnessed him put my mother through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was a lot of things I learned that came out in this juvenile issue about my childhood and my parents that I didn't know. And, you know, one thing I regret, I didn't have the chance to ask my father why. Hmm. You know, but I took this batter's intervention class, and it gave me an understanding as to probably why he was like he was towards my mother.
Hmm.
And it gave me a way to forgive him for what he did to my mother. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know my mother, she always, you know, wore the burden of that it's her fault I'm in prison, because she felt like she lost control of me when she was caught up in her addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like her feeling that way, because at the end of the day, you know, she did the best she could for me during them times. I chose to, you know, run around the neighborhood and with friends and take a life of a man. I chose to do that.
And that is Sidney Roberts. He was speaking to me on the phone from prison. That was just 2 weeks ago. Now, Sidney is set to be released in February. And here's what he told me about getting that news.
It didn't really hit me at first. Then it just came rushing in. I'm like, man, this stuff is for real, you know, because for the longest, you know, it was kind of unbelievable due to the fact that it was taking so long, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now it seems like days are moving at a snail's pace, but I'm ready.
And Sidney added that he's being as careful as he can right now.
I found myself isolating myself more from people because, you know, in prison, a lot of people don't like to see you with these type of blessings.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people wish they was going home, and some people may try to create problems to hope you mess your chance up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that part kind of scares me, you know. But overall, man, I'm just taking the blessing in, and you know, I can't receive the blessing without giving thanks to Miss Amy Bryant, Miss Megan Crane, and the entire family of MacArthur's Justice Center for constantly fighting for us.
And that was Sidney Roberts speaking to me from prison on the phone. He told me he just can't wait to get to work. He says he knows how to sew. He knows how to weld. He dreams of starting a snowplow business. He is ready. And Kevin Bradshaw, I suspect, knows quite a bit about how Sidney is feeling right now. He is the man we spoke to earlier on the show. He was paroled in September after 34 years. Kevin, welcome back.
Hi.
So, Kevin, you've been outside of prison now for 2 months. I'm sure you had a lot of excitement heading up to that. But now that you're out, I'm sure there's also some challenges that go with that. What's been the hardest part of being outside?
Adjusting the family, making myself available for people in my family, and trying to have a good relationship with the kids and my siblings and cousins and aunts and uncles.
So you've got a big family there. They all want to spend time with you.
Right. And I want to spend time with people. So it's just, that's the biggest investment for me so far.
Hmm. We're also joined here by Kevin's attorney, Amy Bryan, who was with us earlier on the show. Amy, welcome back.
Thanks.
And we're joined by Chris Polk. Chris was released in September. Chris, what's been the hardest part for you of being on the outside?
I guess after being away so long that nobody really knows you or understand your character except the people that was there with you the whole while, like my younger brother, for example. But just re-meeting all my family all over again, and to be honest with you, technology has advanced so much.
I bet. Where,
so, you know, and you know, it's the way of the world today. Everything revolves around this phone and things like that. So I had to do some adjusting.
I bet that has been a big adjustment. Kevin, has that been a challenge just to see how much the world has changed?
Yeah, mainly the attitudes of people. I mean, it seems like when I left, it was a lot more considerate.
Hmm.
For the public. Now it seems like people just moving to and fro and they're not as considerate as they used to be.
Hmm. That's a hard thing to adjust to. Chris, I know that you mentioned there your brother. This is your brother, James, and this is kind of an amazing story. He worked two jobs, I understand, for the past 8 years just to pay for a lawyer for you to get you to this point. What has your relationship with him been now that you're out and you're both, you can see each other face to face?
Well, me and James, You know, James is my little brother, but he's actually been my big brother for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And so now that I'm back out in society and I'm trying to establish myself, we have bumped heads over, you know, I'm the big brother, you know.
You want to reclaim that role.
Yeah, I want to reclaim my spot. But for the most part, though, I mean, he's my brother through and through. I mean, I love him to death. And he shows me the same thing. Yeah, me and James, we're a work in progress. We getting it done, though. We getting it done.
That's so great to hear. And, you know, talking to Sidney Roberts, what he kept telling me is he just couldn't wait to get a job. He had so many ideas of what he wanted to do. And I'm curious for the two of you, if you've been able to land jobs. I know you've only been out a very short time period at this point. But, Chris, what are you doing these days?
I'm actually working on my third job.
Whoa.
But I'm doing pretty good in that department. I got a couple of jobs. I got one where I was just promoted on it. I changed positions and
what kind of work are you doing?
I'm a machines operator, welder. I run machine heavy equipment, heavy machinery, and
you already got promoted.
Yeah, I already been promoted.
Kevin, what about you? Have you been able to find a job at this point?
Finding a job wasn't the problem. I had an issue with the Social Security number, so I really couldn't do anything until that was straightened out.
Okay. So you're working through that issue.
Yes, ma'am.
Amy, I was hoping you could speak briefly to this. It seems like the parole board also takes into account, they want to make sure people have a support system around them, and they want to make sure that people can land in meaningful employment. Is that kind of work that they're doing there on that front, has that been helpful to people like your clients?
Well, support upon release is definitely important to ensure that folks are successful when they get out of prison. And it's also a big challenge. I can't speak to how helpful the Department of Corrections is, but there are definitely local organizations and across the state organizations that are helpful, including, I think it really deserves a shout out, St. Louis University's OTIS program, which is a transitional services program through the Occupational Therapy School that's worked with a number of our clients, including both Kevin and Chris, to help identify resources when they're in prison and support them when they get out. And they have been really a tremendous resource for helping our clients who've been serving extreme sentences readjust to living back in the community.
Chris, do you feel like that kind of help, that you have enough help as you need to sort of get your bearings and figure out this much changed universe that you're now in?
Yeah, that helped a whole bunch, a whole lot. I think that's the most important thing to have is a good support system, a good support group. I think anybody that served a significant amount of time that I served, you're going to need that. That's going to determine. I mean, well, your will going to determine if you make it, but that right there, that's significant. That's big. You need support. You're going to need it, especially being gone as long as we've been gone. Mm-hmm. You're going to need support.
I'm wondering, some of you men that have gotten out in the last year, there's been about a half dozen of you. Have you guys been in contact with each other?
I haven't seen anybody that fall up under the same circumstances as myself. I'm trying to think. No, I haven't seen anyone. I mean, I'm talking to guys on the phone that's anticipating a release date.
Okay.
But I haven't actually seen anyone.
Kevin, do you feel like there's people in your life who give you that support you need and sort of understand what you're dealing with right now?
Yeah, most definitely. My family is the biggest support system. They understood. They've been with me for 34 years. So, but I think one of the important things is for guys in my situation to get out of prison is to ask for help and accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be afraid to ask even simple little things. You got to be willing to accept the help.
Yeah, that seems like important advice there. And Amy, I want to talk to you just a bit about, I understand that this legal battle is far from over. First, there are a number of young men who were sentenced as juveniles, and their cases are going to continue to come up for parole after they've spent 25 years in prison. So this could be a pretty lengthy process to take care of all these men who were given these sentences dealing with this retroactively.
Yeah, that's right. Men and women, it's going to be an ongoing thing. There are a lot of hearings happening over the next year because there's a backlog, so to speak. And MacArthur Justice Center has hired a juvenile parole fellow to focus exclusively on representing folks at those hearings, and where we cannot represent them, finding other pro bono attorneys to make sure that every juvenile lifer who wants an attorney in the room at their hearing has one.
I think it's really important to mention in light of the Missouri Attorney General's office has actually appealed the win that the MacArthur Justice Center won on this class action lawsuit. And there's going to be a hearing on this on November 23rd. Amy, what's at stake with this appeal?
Well, you know, the parole board is trying to say that just considering someone for parole alone is enough, even if there's a remote chance they'll get it, even if it's arbitrary decisions, even if they ignore youth. And that just wholly ignores a well-established line of Supreme Court precedent, including the last three big decisions from the Supreme Court that say that life without parole is an unconstitutionally excessive sentence for all but the rarest juvenile offender. It ignores all the data about the very low risk to reoffend that juvenile lifers present. So what's at stake are these protections that we and Hush Blackwell fought for and secured on behalf of a class of about 98 folks. They should be still receiving parole consideration regardless of what the Eighth Circuit says. But what that process looks like could potentially change.
I understand this could have a huge impact on guys who are still in prison, haven't been given a parole date yet. Is there a possibility that it could affect people like Kevin Bradshaw, like Chris Polk, since they received their parole hearings under this process the Attorney General's office is hoping to throw out?
Well, the Department of Corrections and Parole Board haven't made any public statements about that, but an attorney general's office told me it shouldn't impact individuals who already are out or have release dates. And of course, we'll be standing ready to take action if necessary if they in fact do try to take away out dates from folks who earned them.
Okay. We did reach out to Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt. His press team said they would have no comment on pending litigation. In our last minute here, Chris Polk, I want to turn this to you. What goes through your mind when you think about how the state is actually fighting to undo this, to say that people like you who are still in prison should have to stay there?
I don't get it, to be quite frank and honest. I just don't get it. I think this, I don't get it. It don't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. What would you want people to know about guys like you, people who maybe did something very bad, but also did a lot of time in prison for it?
I would want someone to know that there's a lot of growth and development that goes along in that process. It's so many people that have matured, and those same people would never, ever, in a million years, ever reoffend again.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we all make mistakes.
And you served your time.
And you served your time, but it's just. It's so much. Mm-hmm. It's so much that goes on with that process, and it's so much growth, it's so much development, it's so much. Man, I can't explain.
Well, Chris Polk, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story.
Thank you.
And Kevin Bradshaw, thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And Amy Bryan, co-director of the MacArthur Justice Center, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for your time, Sarah. Appreciate it.
St. Louis on the Air is produced by Evie Hempel, Lara Hamden, Emily Woodbury, and Alex Hoyer. The audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Sarah Fenske. Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.